You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 39 of A Life in Ruins podcast, where we investigate the careers of those living a life in ruins. I am your host, Carlton Gover, and I am joined by my co-hosts, C.C. Johnin and David Ian Howe. In this episode, Emily Van Alt, PhD candidate at the Indiana University Bloomington, has returned to deliver some exciting news and to fill us in on the current state of Indigenous archaeologies in the field. Emily was one of our first guests on the podcast, appearing in episode 3, Rock Arden and Roland with Emily Van Alt, which I originally wanted to title the episode Painting with All the Colors of the Rock Art. So please join us in welcoming Emily back to our show. Emily, thank you so much for being on. How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as one can do in a global pandemic. Thanks for having me back. It's always a lot of fun to chat with you guys about archaeology.
We're glad to have you back.
Thanks.
And just knowing you personally, how many days have you left your house since this pandemic began?
I think 6 days.
What?
Yeah. So fun fact, I actually had open heart surgery when I was a baby.
Oh.
My heart was pumping blood backwards. Wild. So I'm totally good and fine now. It's just like probably wouldn't be the best if I got COVID. So I have been like basically full quarantine since March 13th. Which is when I took my qualifying exam. So it was like the last day that everybody saw each other. And now I'm just stuck in my house working on various projects. So
that's wild. That's a long time to be in your house. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, no, it's, you know what? It is what it is. I'm trying to make the best out of it. But yeah, it's kind of wild.
You guys have some pretty sweet digs in Bloomington, and you got two cats, Link and Zelda, and of course you have Max. So it could be worse. It could be worse.
It's just a lot of video games and TV. So yeah, it could be worse though.
Indeed. So since we last had you on, I believe in like April of May in 2019, almost 2 years ago.
Yeah.
What have you been up to? You just mentioned you've become a PhD candidate and you did your quals, but what else is going on?
Yeah, so I finished up my coursework and I sat down for my qualifying exams, which was written and oral defense of my answers. And part of that was writing about and talking about Indigenous archaeology and where I think that is going to sort of go into the future, especially with our generation, Carlton and I and others. And so one of the other things that was supposed to happen, but COVID, was Carlton and I had put on a panel. We're going to put on a panel at Society of American Archaeology about Indigenous archaeology. And unfortunately, that got canceled. But that was one of the things that Carlton and I were working on. And currently, I'm actually the American Indian Studies Research Institute graduate fellow. So I essentially get to work on my own research for this year, which is really awesome. And I'm really fortunate for that opportunity. And I've really just been working mostly on this edited volume that we're going to talk about tonight. And I've been working on a Wennergren grant for my dissertation research. And hopefully, fingers crossed, if technology will allow it, I'll be submitting my National Science Foundation grant Tuesday of this week. So it doesn't seem like a lot, but for those who know, grant writing is basically writing your pre-dissertation. So trying to figure out your sort of your theory, your methods, all those things, which can be really helpful before you go to sit down to write your dissertation. So that's sort of what I've been working on since.
Just a couple small things, grants, yeah. Life, you know, things.
Yeah. Well, yeah, life. Mac and I got engaged. So, you know, just a few small life things that have happened.
Congrats.
Thanks.
Congrats.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I don't know if you have continued to listen to the podcast since your episode or if you just tuned us out. And if you did, that is perfectly fine because I don't even like hearing myself talk. But if you have listened to anything, have you noticed any changes in either good episodes that you liked or things that we've done through the podcast?
Yeah, I admit that I don't listen to podcasts as much as I probably should as a good academic, but you guys, it's been just crazy to see how much you guys have taken off and how many listeners you have versus like, you know, I was episode 3. I don't know. I think all of your episodes are really, really good. I'm slightly partial to Mackenzie Corey's because he is my fiance, but that was actually a really, I think, really important discussion that you guys had about the archaeology of childhood, but also sort of the end and discussing, you know, issues with advisors. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about your guys' podcast is it's not just, you know, people's research. And obviously that's important. And you guys are showing off sort of young researchers. But I think the other thing is you guys talk about sort of the ins and outs of academia and of, you know, working in this discipline. So I'm really happy to see that. I think it's really important to do that when you're doing this sort of sci-com type stuff. So, yeah. You guys are doing an awesome, awesome job.
There's also a lot of singing in that episode for some reason.
Yes, there's also that. And you guys just continue to have a really fun time. You guys are really entertaining as co-hosts. So that's always nice when you're listening to a podcast, keeping it lively, not just academic stuff.
Yeah, I was actually re-listening to Mac's episode this morning as I was like making breakfast and just like laughing the entire time. There's definitely been that is, in my opinion, one of my more enjoyable episodes. Like I love every episode that we've done. Just some are easier to go back to and smile about and not cringe. And I think Max is one of those.
It's because I was gone for half of it.
Your Maybelline commercial got in the way, dude. It's okay.
Kind of looking forward for you. What do you envision doing this next summer if, you know, the world keeps itself together and there's a vaccine and you're allowed to go do field work? What do you anticipate doing?
Yeah, so fingers crossed, there's a lot of sort of, you know, other factors that play into this. But the hope is that I would get either a Winter Grant or a National Science Foundation grant and be able to do research. And that entails going to rock art sites, visiting with community members, and doing interviews and those sort of methods that go into my dissertation research. But it's really hard with COVID, not only because it's like my own personal safety with COVID, but also, you know, Native people are some of the hardest hit communities right now with COVID. So it's really based on what the Oglala Sioux tribal government, you know, decides on safety issues with COVID. If not, I do Winter Gren this year asked for a plan B. So if COVID gets worse. And so basically I'm trying to figure out how to do this virtually, digitally, and keep it as safe as possible. But fingers crossed, I get to go into the field, visit a few more rock art sites, hopefully take community members to those sites to do some Indigenous interpretation. Since I've talked to you guys for episode 3, I've also added a ethnobotany component to my research because I think plants are definitely part of this sort of larger landscape surrounding rock art sites and might give us a few clues. There's actually an article that came out in CNN, I think, like 2 weeks ago, how they found plant remains at a rock art site and they used those plants, they're called pinwheels, to actually interpret the rock art images. They thought they were just geometric. They were actually plants. So I think there's definitely this connection that exists between plants and rock art. So that's definitely another sort of component I'm hoping to research in the summer.
Yeah, and you missed out on an opportunity because of COVID this last summer. So what were you supposed to do during the summer of 2020? And what did you end up doing instead?
So I was supposed to go to the south of France with Casey Carlson and do like a photographing rock art sites in the south of France, going to them, seeing some of the oldest rock art images in the world, which has always sort of been a dream of mine. And then COVID happened, which is such a bummer. But hopefully one day I'll get to go to France.
And that was funded by who?
Oh, yeah, that was funded through Society of American Archaeology, their National Science Foundation Indigenous training grant that they have. So I was supposed to go there through that fellowship. So yeah, it was definitely kind of like really kind of shitty, but hopefully in the future that will happen for me. But instead, I was really fortunate enough to work for the new Indiana University Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology, which I call UMA, but I don't think that's catching on quite yet. but I hate having to say the big long, title. But they basically merged the ethnographic part of a museum and the archaeology part of a museum to create the Archaeology Anthropology Museum here. In combining those collections, which is cool. But they had their very first sort of the inaugural Native American summer fellowship. And because it was digital, actually, instead of two Native American fellows, we had five Native American fellows. Actually, Carlton ended up being one of our guest speakers, and he told us about the work that he's doing with the Pawnee Nation, which was awesome. That was one of our students' favorite talks that was given for the fellowship. So I worked on that and met five really amazing Native women who are working in anthropology, archaeology, and museum studies. Two of them are actually going to be in this edited volume because of their work. And it was amazing. It was so cool to get to meet them, even though it was virtually, and see the work and see how they're indigenizing museums. So that's what I did this summer, on top of teaching a class and working on my prospectus and a National Science Foundation grant. So though COVID happened, I had a very busy summer.
Well, that's super awesome. Good job getting things done.
Thanks.
I wish I could say I did like a 16th of that, or even a little bit of that. That's super cool. Carlton, do you mind talking about what you presented on, or is it kind of still building off your PhD stuff?
No, I think if I recall, it was more of, it wasn't like talking about my research. It was more of a Emily and Dr. Ed Herman asked me to kind of talk about my experiences as an Indigenous person in anthropology and museum. So it was more of a like, this is what I do with the Pawnee Nation. This is how I do it. And like, as these are my experiences as, you know, a mixed person, you know, passing white. So that was kind of brought up, and really just kind of like telling these students, like, even though we were sitting on like 2-3 decades worth of progress in incorporating Indigenous ontologies into anthropology museums, like there's still work to be done. And you guys need to recognize that as up and coming scholars, that this is not a golden brick road that will bring you to Oz, that you need to be prepared to overcome challenges and recognize the best paths for you moving forward.
Yeah, we called them Workshop Wednesdays, and they were essentially, we wanted to bring in specifically Native scholars working in museums and anthropology, so that one, we are connecting the fellows to other Native people working in their field, which can be kind of hard to do, that sort of connecting, especially with the pandemic. And these are all, you know, students who have just graduated with their BA or just started grad school. So, you know, very young scholars. And so, yeah, we did Workshop Wednesdays with Native people. And we, you know, we talked about all sorts of different issues when it comes to being a Native person in anthropology and working in museums. And yeah, Carlton was great. He talked about all sorts of things. And I think it was good for them to see, you know, another young Native person doing this type of work. And it was awesome. Carlton gave a kick-ass talk.
Thank you. And who else did you guys have on Workshop Wednesdays?
Oh, we had Sonia Adelaide give a talk. Yeah.
Squeal.
Yeah, that was amazing. We had one of my aunties, Royce Freeman, who she actually is working on, I think they're going to be done next year, the new Mandan Hidatsa Rikara Museum, which was very cool. And she's a PhD candidate at Oklahoma. So she's finishing her PhD while opening up this museum for her nation. And then, yeah, Sonia Adelaide, which was great. And then we had Jesse Ricker Crawford, who works at the American Indian Arts Institute. And she specifically is a professor in Indigenous curation for them. So we had her speak, and that was also amazing. So we had a lot of really amazing Native scholars come in and give us talks.
So I've always had a question. Much like the, you know, society of people who hide the truth about giants and aliens that we belong to, do Indigenous like students in the SAA, or, you know, just in archaeological like circles, like, do you guys have a group, or like, you know, group chat, or, you know, conference, like separate conference that you guys all like chat with, like to collaborate on all these things? Or is it just at the SAAs that you guys all kind of meet up and collaborate as well?
It's weird. I feel like I've met people mostly, like other Native folks, online, like through Twitter and Instagram, that's how I've gotten followers and met people. I met Carlton at a Plains conference, like, what was that, like 3 years ago, I think. And then I've met a few other folks at SAAs, but we don't have like our own I think there's like a Society of Native Anthropologists, but there, I don't think there's one of archaeologists. But I do know that it's been talked about. Like, yo, we need to get all these like Native archaeologists in a room and talk about stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Because I remember you and Carlton going like to, it was like a student hour or something like that at the SAs in Albuquerque, but I couldn't remember. But,
the Native American welcoming thing. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Why is that so funny?
It took like an hour because
it was ridiculous. Yeah, Connor, go on.
No, I was just like, you were saying that it like took like an hour or two just to get through like introductions.
Oh, right, like, right. Yeah. Yeah,
it was just like it was a whole thing.
Because we did lunch, then we did the giant thing, and then we did that.
Yeah, it was like, it's like they wanted everyone to introduce themselves, and it's like it's just an hour of people going on around the room, and you're just like, Jesus. And then it's kind of like over. It's like really weird. There's not really a presentation. It's like, we just want everyone to, I don't know why I'm doing this voice. We just want everyone to, know each other. And it's like, and nothing really comes out of it. In a meaningful way. I mean, I've met like Larry Zimmerman through that because I was like, oh, that's what he looks like.
Oh my god, that's so real. What ends up happening is there's all these people from like older archaeologists that show up that have been really great allies to Native people. Like I met Meg Conkey there and like died. But it's a lot of like you get there and you're like, oh my god, there's that like famous archaeologist. But then you don't actually like have the gumption to go introduce yourself. You're just like, wow, I can't believe I'm in the same room as them. And then you just leave. So, yeah.
On that note, we are going to leave this first segment and peace out, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Welcome back to episode 39 of A Life in Ruins podcast. We're here with Emily Van Alst. You might remember her from, was I third episode of A Life in Ruins podcast?
Episode Trace. Yep.
Yep.
Cool. Sweet. Emily.
Yes.
Take it away.
Okay.
That was the best segue. Just not an introduction. Just like,
just have
it. Just do what you want.
Okay. I mean, I'm not the host, but I'll try my best.
Wait. So, Emily, I hear there's an interesting story about how you and Carlton decided to get this edited volume together. Do you mind telling it to us?
Sure, I can do that. So Carlton and I were hanging out, I think it was, 2019 SAAs, which was in Albuquerque?
2019, it was at the Wyoming Roundup.
Yes, so it was at the Wyoming Roundup, which I got to go to because Mac. And plus, I know so many Wyoming people at this point. And Carlton and I were sitting at, I don't even know what the bar was called, but it was very, Southwest. And I think Carlton ordered like two tequila shots, and I remember taking the shot and then looking at Carlton and Carlton being like, we got to change archaeology. And I was like, that seems like a really large request, and I'm not sure how we're going to do that. And he's like, no, we got to do this. I'm like, okay. So I remember taking out my phone and we wrote notes. I don't know if they were necessarily coherent notes, but we did talk about creating a SAA like large session about Indigenous archaeology, like what are the next steps? And we specifically talked about how the majority of Indigenous archaeology that's been written about in an academic context has been incredibly theoretical. And I think that this new generation of archaeologists are really interested in putting that sort of into practice. What do Indigenous archaeology methodologies look like? And so I think we wrote a few names down of like Native folks that we knew. And then we didn't really talk about it for a while. And then it was, I think, when SAAs is like, hey, you should do a session email. Carlton and I chatted on the phone. We were like, we should actually bring people together and do this. So we contacted a bunch of people and we got the session of like, it was going to go. And about a month before SAAs, we got contacted by University of Florida Press. And they apparently had gone through the like giant book that ends up happening of like all the sessions with all the people presenting at SAAs. And they were like, yeah, we think that your session is really interesting and we think it would be a great edited volume. And we were like, okay, we have no idea how to do this, but that sounds cool. And like, that's the golden ticket on your CV, right? So COVID happened and obviously SAAs got canceled. We were really bummed. But then I decided to reach out to see if Florida Press would still be interested in doing a volume. And the acquisitions people were like, yeah, this would be really, really fantastic. So we decided to go for it and do an edited volume. But we had to do a proposal. So Carlton and I spent like, what, all of August?
It took a long time. Like the process from like University of Florida Press reaching out to us to like literally 4 hours ago when I finally signed the contract was several months, like at least 6 months.
Basically been all of COVID.
Yeah.
It's been like March to now. So, yeah.
And it was brutal.
Yeah. So stuff they don't tell you about when it comes to academia and publishing is that you have to, like, just because somebody reaches out, like a press reaches out to you, you're like, oh, awesome, cool. Like, we are probably going to get this book or whatever. It was like, okay, now you have to do like, what was it, Carlton? Like a 3 to 5 page proposal?
I have the document up, actually. Okay. Yeah. So all single spaced, by the way. You have to come up with the title of the damn thing. Description, who's your audience, other books, schedule and specifications, author, editor information, annotated table of contents, abstracts for chapters, CVs, work sample. It was a lot. And Emily will be first author on this editor volume because she did all of this. Like, it was very much like we, from the beginning, it was like Emily will be first author because she's actually like a functioning academic, whereas I'm just kind of like,
oh, thanks,
Forrest Gump, and just kind of do what I'm told. And so this is mostly all this is Emily. But the compromise out of that was I got to write 2 chapters in the book with Emily being a co-author on one of those. So it's like we're sharing. But yeah, and then I literally just signed the contract 4 hours ago.
Yeah.
Thinking about this, it was a lot, and there was meetings.
Yeah.
Because we thought just having someone reach out to us and tell us we're brilliant, we're like, okay, that's the golden ticket into the chocolate factory.
Yep.
And it was like, no, we think this is interesting, but you have to prove it's interesting to our committee. And we had a resounding first time, we want this book.
Yep.
So you had to write a pre-book for the book?
Yeah. It's like how you have to write a prospectus for your dissertation, basically.
Yeah. Very similar.
Yeah. And so we thought that we had gotten everything together, and I had sent it to our acquisitions person, and she was like, yeah, I'm going to need abstracts from all of your authors. And we were like, there's going to be 12 chapters in this. And she's like, yep. So we had to sit there and email and try to get everybody to send it in, which nobody really got it in on time. So it was an extra 3 weeks of making sure we got all our abstracts for each individual chapter. So that was a lot of work. But thank you to our contributors.
They
gave us really great abstracts. I think it really sealed the deal for our proposal.
Yeah. And I think they were all pretty excited too. Like, it wasn't just like, tell me more about it. We were like, this is from the onset, like, this is what we want to do. This is the purpose. And then everyone who responded back, because I think we ended up hitting up like 15 or 16 indigenous scholars.
Yeah.
And all the people that did respond responded overwhelmingly positive. Like, yeah, I got this. And it's a lot of students too.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that we had to specifically put in our proposal was that, yeah, we understand that these are a bunch of young scholars who are, you know, up and coming. But, you know, majority of paradigm shifts within disciplines happen because graduate students are looking back at the old literature, looking at the theory and thinking, how can we apply this to our current research? And what does this look like in the future? So shout out to my advisor, Dr. Pyburn, for being like, no, think about how gender shifted in archaeology and theoretically, you know, that was young graduate students who were thinking about those things. So she was like, you have to put that in there. And our acquisitions person is like, yeah, make sure you talk about how important it is that it's young people who are doing this kind of work. So yeah, I think that also was really like strong in our proposal.
That's really cool. And it'll, you know, I guess another aspect to it is that you guys all get to add this into your CV, and that becomes something that boosts the potential for future jobs, future anything like that. So I think that's really cool that it's kind of this focus on a paradigm shift while actively promoting indigenous archaeology and ideas. And I think it's brilliant. I think you guys, that's super cool.
When we are in theory class, and you just mentioned that, like, you know, it's a paradigm shift with gender archaeology, you know, in the 60s, right? We have to read all that stuff, like Sally Slocum and, you know, the feminist wave of archaeology. We got to read that stuff. So now there's like a huge indigenous push in archaeology. And there's obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement, there's going to be that kind of push. With your guys' volume, like, is it weird to you guys that like your book's going to be used in like theory classes and stuff? Or like, have you thought about that yet? Because it's weird. Like, you guys are talking about it. That's what I'm thinking of. But I don't know. Has that sunk in?
I don't think it's sunk in yet. I don't know for Carlton. But, you know, one of the things in the proposal was, you know, who is the audience for this? And we thought really long and hard about that, because it's like a lot of times it's just for, you know, academics. But what does that actually mean? And we talked about, you know, Carlton and I have both taught now intro to archaeology courses. And there's not really a book that talks specifically about what does this look like on the ground? How does this actually help communities? And I know that my own students were, you know, asking like, okay, this seems really cool. And I think we should definitely include Native people in archaeology, but how do we actually do that? And their archaeology book wasn't telling them that. It was just saying, you know, yeah, there's been some people who've written about this, and not really telling them exactly how to do it. And if we're going to create a bunch of archaeologists, whether it's CRM archaeologists or academic ones or, you know, wherever they work, I think they need to know exactly what this looks like on the ground within communities. So that's kind of our thinking. Carlton, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I think for me, going back to that, I think we ended up taking like 5 shots of tequila. That whole purpose of me trying to say like, we need to change archaeology. And as Emily said, like we reflected on like up until that point, and still, unfortunately, today in 2020, all the indigenous archaeology is from an indigenous perspective is really theoretical. Now, I've seen collaborative work done in Mesoamerica and the Southwest where they talk about using it and how working with the community on oral traditions is great. But that's kind of been the focus. And so when looking at what I see as a methods volume, really, that's applying theory into practice through a multitude of ways. Like, it's not just archaeology. We have Lydia Curlis from the Nipmuc Nation at Brown University Library. She's looking at through library curation. And then we also have museum folks. So it's not just the artifacts coming out of the ground, but also what happens to objects and cultural patrimony once it leaves the field. And how does this indigenous way of thinking about the past move beyond just excavation, but also into collections? And then how is the data distributed and curated? So it's like a holistic approach. And because of this, you know, the core of our audience is, and we mentioned this in our book, like this is not meant for like tenured professors, because to me and Emily, it's kind of too late for them. So we're writing it towards undergraduates, tribal historic preservation officers, NACPRA officers. So it's really written for the next generation. So that way they have this toolkit from early on that they can reflect on and work towards. Because that's what we're kind of looking at, is like, how do we take this and showcase this and then move it forward? So that's kind of the goal of this, is that addressing something that we wish we had early on in our graduate careers.
Well, I guess the reason I ask that is the next time you guys have like an inkling of, I have imposter syndrome or something like that, you know, like when that creeps up. I don't know if you've seen those TikToks where it's like the guy standing in the doorway and then like the weird, like evil thought like appears out of the closet or something like that.
Yes, I've seen those.
Yeah. Okay. You know what I'm talking about. You have this book now. So like, I think you guys should be pretty proud of that because it's pretty cool. I just talk into the wind on other stuff, but...
Actually, there was, thank you, David, that does mean a lot. One of our chapters in this book, the one that me and Emily are co-authoring, it's called Applying Indigenous Ethicality in the 21st Century and Beyond. And like a major part of that comes from your work in social media and other people's work in social media. Not saying that you've done anything wrong, but like recognizing that there's a need for conversation about like, well, how do you represent Indigenous people online in the 21st century? And that was really like, I'm starting to pull this together now because Emily can talk about this next about TAG coming up. Yeah. So it's actually like giving back to you in terms of like what you've done is that you've inspired us to write a chapter specifically focused on your success.
Yeah, David, you've done a really interesting job on social media. And so we wanted to highlight that, and we wanted to think about, you know, how, yeah, like Carlton said, how do people represent Native people online? You know, Native people obviously can represent themselves, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you can't not talk about Native folks, especially when it comes to archaeology. So what does that look like, and how can you do that ethically?
Sure. Well, I'm glad I can help in any way. It's nice to know it's doing something.
Yeah, I actually planned on a group conversation with us and then the Avengers, like basically having other people who do all this social media work. What would they like to know, or examples that they've done, so that I can include it into the chapter? So this was kind of like me surprising you guys on air. Like, this is coming out. You guys have both, you, David, and also Connor, your guys' contributions to this upcoming book, which you guys will be recognized for.
Surprise.
Every week, I don't want to say this loud on air, my therapist is always like, say something nice about yourself, and I like just straight up can't, because I have to joke, and she's like, one thing, and I'm like, I brush my teeth in the kitchen so they'll look at myself, and she's like, no, say something nice. I can say this now, so we're good. That took a turn. I'm so sorry. Keep going.
Second dark.
And then I guess just to wrap this up, it was Emily's idea to, since our session at SAA's 2020 was canceled, that we thought, now that we have the edited volume and we notified our authors, Emily's like, we should present on TAG, the Theoretical Archaeological Group conference coming up, which will be virtual, as a means to, like, we have everyone's abstracts, but to start the presentation so we can try to keep to the deadline. And if it's okay with you guys, can I just read the authors and the nations that we have on the volume, as, because some of them listen, and I think it'd be great to kind of highlight them.
Absolutely.
No.
So thank you, David. Emily C. Van Alts, Lakota, Carlton Shield Chief Gover, Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, of course, Lydia Curlis, Nipmuc Nation, Brown University Library, Patrick Cruz, Okawinge, Pueblo, University of Colorado Boulder, Honey Constant, Sturgeon Lake First Nation, Saskatchewan, University of Saskatchewan, Wenuskewin Heritage Park, Sonia Miller. I don't know how to say her last name.
I don't either, and I feel really bad, but we love you, Sonia.
Yeah, Litton Band of Pomo Indians, Zoe Eddy, Huron-Wendat Ojibwe, Assistant Director of Undergraduate Anthropology Department, Harvard University, Nicholas C. LaLook, White Mountain Apache, Northern Arizona University, Department of Anthropology, Assistant Professor, Ashley Thompson, Red Lake Ojibwe, PhD Candidate, Department of Anthropology, University of Arizona, Aaron B. Bryan, Absaluk Nation, Big Lodge Clan, Research Core Team, Indigenous Research Center and Faculty, Tribal Historic Preservation at Salish Kootenai College. S. Margaret Spivey Faulkner, shout out to Dr. Shane Miller for introducing. She's PD, Assistant Professor, Department of Anthropology, University of Alberta. K. Kakandasat Matine, Loon Clan Citizen, Potawatomi Nation, PhD student at University of Massachusetts and Department of Anthropology. And yeah, that's it. So we got 12 different nations represented from all across the country. So not just Southwest, but kind of a smattering of people from the Southwest, Plains, Southeast, Northeast, and Canada. So really trying to represent the U.S. and Canada holistically as we can. So, and that will be it for this session. Please join us after these messages for segment 3 with Emily Van Alst here on episode 39.
Welcome back to episode 39 of A Life in Ruins podcast. We're talking with Emily Van Alst. I wanted to ask both Carlton and Emily, you alluded to that you have multiple articles within this edited volume, and I wanted to kind of hear what those are about. So Emily, if you don't mind talking about one of your 16 ones that you are a part of.
Yeah. So, and I think this goes for a lot of the other chapters in the volume, because a lot of us are young scholars. It's kind of based on our own research. So for me, my own chapter is going to be about my sort of methods, like an indigenized rock art method. Exactly what does that look like? It's not something that's really been conceived of yet. So I'm hoping that this chapter is going to kind of serve double as like also my dissertation methods chapter, or at least this will be a good like practice run, I guess, before my dissertation. But yeah, it's essentially the sort of methods I laid out in the first section of, you know, I'm going to be doing interviews with community members about their sort of their cultural background related to the images I'm looking at. And then I'm going to hopefully be able to take community members to rock art sites that they've historically been denied access to. So there's this sort of returning process that I hope happens. And then actually interpreting rock art images there. So a lot of the times when it comes to rock art methods, you go, you take photos, maybe some measurements of some images, and then you take it sort of back to the lab, so to speak, and to analyze. But I want to see Native people engaging with the rock art that the way that they think needs to happen. I'm also doing this sort of method called cultural mapping, which is sort of big in like environmental anthro, but I'm going to see if I can apply it to archaeological methods. It's called going on a walkabout. So essentially you walk the landscape and you're interviewing, you know, community members. So not just in front of the rock art panel, but sort of the like larger landscape around the rock art site. I'm also going to do a floral inventory. So looking at, are there particular plants that are there that Native people still use today? Were those plants planted there on accident or on purpose? I've noticed in my preliminary work that there has been really important plants that Native people use in ceremony. And so I'm hoping that combining all those methods will create a more indigenized method of understanding rock art. So we're not understanding rock art as art, but we're understanding it as almost like an archive and a knowledge system. And so it's just much more than this sort of Western art tradition, which is how rock art is normally analyzed. So that's sort of my chapter of bringing together the sort of Western archaeology rock art methods, but really bringing in the sort of indigenous rock art method that I hope to sort of create, I guess, out of this project.
That's super cool. That's super awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah. I'm excited to read it at some point when Carlton gives us free copies. Carlton, yeah. What is your chapter about?
So I was planning on giving you and David both a copy because I think we're given, what was it, five or seven, Emily, we get free copies?
Yeah, I think it's 5 or 7 free copies, and then we get 40% off after that.
Yeah. So
contract says.
Yeah, I think so. So I think, yeah, that was my plan anyways.
Oh, you're too nice, man. You're way too nice.
Yeah, you guys deal with me in my highly organized sense of this entire project. So there has to be some benefit. Use it as a, you know, table stabilizer. I don't care. My chapter is, it's basically how I did my master's thesis, which is heavily invested in the use of Bayesian statistical analysis using the program OxCal. And so I've, in my experience and the experience of other people that are familiar with Bayesian and OxCal, it's a pretty intimidating process because it's a very specific form of coding. So my chapter is a review of my thesis and basically a step-by-step guide of my code, why I chose the code, how I analyzed indigenous oral traditions through a critical lens that you would usually do of any historical account to pick out the information necessary to provide background, explaining the code itself in more layman's terms that I understand. I've had to read some articles several times, actually once a month. I have a day set out, and this is a shout out to Eric Robinson for recommending this, that I basically the first Wednesday of every month, I break out my old Bayesian papers and I reread 6 papers. And every time I read them, I add more notes because I find something new. So I wanted to condense that process and provide better access to other scholars, not just indigenous scholars, about how you can use Bayesian in your collaborative approaches to understanding indigenous histories prior to Columbus, and in particular when talking about the plains southwest and the west prior to Spanish colonization. So unlike Emily, I'm not really going to be able to use this for my dissertation, but it's more of something that I think is critical because there is a barrier for any archaeologist who wants to use OxCal with sophisticated models rather than just pure plugging in a date to get whatever it sits on the radiocarbon curve. So mine will be much more methods based and probably not an enjoyable read. So that's kind of why I was like, Emily, we need to do a social media chapter because I know that one will probably get cited more in general and be more applicable to not just indigenous people, but everybody, like, oh, right, we're in the 21st century. Maybe we can utilize some of these, or at least provide a guide that I've noticed. You know, I get questions, not just from David and Connor, but others who are like, hey, how do I represent Indigenous people, or what's the right way to go about it? So I was like, you know, if we had a book chapter about it, then we have a source where we can send people to. And if there's faults in that, they can blame us rather than taking any heat from the internet. So
also very cool. I love Bayesian and statistics. So I'm super stoked on that. It's exhilarating stuff.
I think Eric Robinson will hate it, but he's going to help. He'll help me edit it, and then I'll make sure it's good with him. But yeah, I just think it's something that needed to, you know, it's more of an impetus of the necessity rather than like, believe me, writing about Bayesian is not what I want to do, but it just needs to be done. So
yeah, absolutely. And especially if you spend so much time working on things like that, you might as well put it out into the world for other people to use, you know?
Absolutely.
Bayesian.
All about that Bayesian.
Oh, no, Jesus.
No trouble.
Oh boy, maybe next time, Connor. So I guess I'll just segue into this the way that we wanted to finalize this is that through the course of this podcast, we have interviewed Indigenous people. We've talked about Indigenous issues. And something that I feel has come up, especially if you listen to some of our previous episodes where we talked to non-Indigenous people, that there is a metaphorical tightrope that people walk when talking about Indigenous issues in their work. I've had discussions, you know, with Connor and David when they ask for advice. And so what I wanted to do here with Emily being present is to provide a space in which, you know, David and Connor can ask questions about Indigenous archaeologies or protocol from a place of like genuinely wanting to know, not out of ignorance, but like I, you know, just giving them the opportunity to ask questions that maybe Emily can answer. So that is what this is. And so, yeah, this is really an open forum to ask maybe some questions that Connor and David have.
Connor, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll take the first one. And this, I don't think this ever got resolved for me, but David had posted something about an Indigenous group of people, and he got a lot of flack for using the past tense when referring to them. And I guess it makes sense that we should refer to them in the present tense going forward. But how would you recommend that we ultimately deal with that, especially because there's a lot of different names and nomenclatures that are used as part of this?
Can I add to that before Emily answers, if you don't mind?
Yeah.
So with that specific one, what made it so difficult was like I was talking about like the archaeological culture of, you know, the Iroquoian groups of New York and Canada. And I wasn't sure, like, obviously, I don't think the entire group subsides on spearfishing with like firelight spearfishing is what I was talking about. So I said, like, you know, they used to do that in that sense. But then like also their political system, I said, like, they would vote or something like that on in a democratic system and things like that, are they, the clan mothers would vote for sachems who represented the government. But then in that case, they still do that. But in the other part of the post, it's like, that's kind of in the past, you know? And it, then somebody was like, but it still needs to be present tense. And it's still, it's like, it's a tightrope, you know, as Connor, I think, just said.
So it's obviously a very difficult thing to write about Native people in the present who also had ancestors who had agency and did things in the past. I take a lot of my own, the way that I write about Native people in my community, sort of from Native American and Indigenous studies. I think reading that type of literature, I think, is incredibly helpful when trying to write about Native people. And I know for myself, I've struggled with this, and I've gotten feedback on grants and on papers before of like, you switch a lot between the present and the past when you're writing. And for me, it's very difficult because it's like, it's sort of what you're running into, David. It's like, okay, well, traditionally we would do this thing that we still do today. So it's like, how do you write about that? And being respectful to Native people when writing about their ancestors and the actions of their ancestors. For me, because it's a very like difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. I normally start my paragraphs with like, today, as in the past, Lakota women X, Y, and Z. Or I'll say like, today we do this one thing. Traditionally, we do this thing that is very similar to what we do today. So I think that sort of you are on the right track, right? With like connecting the past and the present, and that line seems sort of blurred when you're reading through something sometimes. Right. It's a really hard thing to do, but I definitely say like, read through Native and Indigenous studies papers and books, because the way that they write is like, I think, the way to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any book recommendations for Caleb Welch?
I don't know. It depends on the topic. I mean, Native studies is so vast that there's just so much. I mean, maybe if you are an archaeologist or anthropologist, I recommend reading Ella Deloria and Beatrice Medicine. I think they do a really good job at looking at the, like, writing about Native people in the present and connecting it to the past and to ancestors. That would be my two recommendations.
I think Carlton was joking because Caleb Welch always asks that on, I think, every post or something.
Oh, I know. That's why I laugh. Like, everyone I
But yeah, I think that was a good answer, because especially with that post, like, and that leads into my next question too, because I guess this is twofold, but I waited a long time to post that one because I wanted to make sure it was right. And I spent a long time editing it, and I sent it to my editor. He edited it and it was good. And then I was like, okay, I think this is fine enough to post. And then I finally posted it. I reached out to an Iroquois museum up in New York, and they were like, yeah, sure, we'll take a look at it, we'll send it to a Seneca interpreter. And I said, cool. And they like, I sent it, and then like just never got back to me, and they said, yeah, they took a look at it, and that's like all I like heard. It's cool. And they just like never got back afterwards, and they're probably busy or whatever. But then I was just like kind of waiting, and I had to post the, because I have like a schedule I kind of like go with. And then I was like, all right, I'll just post it. And they said it was great, like after I posted it, and they're like, good job. But then like the person that had made that comment about, you know, like, these people still exist, you should use this in present tense. And they said it very nicely. I just can't remember what it was. It's like, I put so much time into that and did everything I could to make it correct. And then, I mean, I could have done more, but then like a whole bunch of people like that one comment, and then just like people read it and think like, oh, this guy sucks. But I'm sure they don't think that, but it's just like, dang it, you can't win, you know. But it still did well, and like people still learn, so it's whatever to me. But I don't know, it's difficult. And like you said, when you're writing that paper, it's easy to switch between past and present tense in general when writing, so it's just hard.
And kind of going off of that, what is the best way for us people who are interested in different groups, what is the best method of collaboration if we're going to post something about different Indigenous peoples or talk about something that we might have kind of an idea about? What is the best method for that kind of collaboration?
I think that you had like the right intention, David, of like finding, you know, not just like the most random, like, you know, person who's related to the Iroquois Confederacy and being like, hey, can you look at this? But like finding an education or cultural center or like a museum, like you said, that deals with that. So you're not asking a random Native person for their labor just because they happen to be Indigenous, but, you know, going specifically to somewhere that is what they specialize in, is sort of cultural education. So that, I think that totally makes sense as a first start. I think collaboration seems easier said than done. And so it can be incredibly challenging because, like, yeah, you want to post something, but Native people don't necessarily owe you their time, right? Like, that sounds kind of crappy, but at the same time, like, Native people have other issues in their communities that they're dealing with.
Yeah.
And so, but I think, you know, reaching out to a cultural center is a great start. Or if you know a Native person who works in that realm, reaching out, I think, totally makes sense. But collaboration is a lot of relationship building. So I think it can be really hard, especially if this is like an Instagram post, right? Like, a lot of the stuff that I've read that is about community archaeology, community-based practices when doing this type of work is that you spend years building relationships with Native people. It's not just sort of like a one time you ask something and then you go. It's a constant building of that relationship. So I think it can be really hard to do that collaboration, especially at first, because you have to do a lot of work in building that relationship and building trust, right? Like Native people don't necessarily trust the anthropologists and archaeologists. We all know that that history there is tense and it's dark. And so it can be really hard for a Native person to just give you information. So building that relationship and gaining that trust from communities, I think is really important. I don't have a solid answer when it comes to like social media and like a post about a community. Carlton, I don't know if you want to add anything, because I don't have a perfect answer for this.
Someone straight up just DM'd me and said, hey, can I send you a copy of my book to read? Speaking of like, I don't owe anybody my time. Like, screw you. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I know, like, especially when it comes to social media, because it's kind of like a new way of collaboration. It can be tricky, especially like in the middle of COVID, right? There's a lot going on. It's hard to get a hold of people in general. I do know like the artist that David commissioned, she reached out to me. And I think I scared her on accident because she like reached out like, hey, do you know anything about the Iroquois? And I was like on a hike with my family and I have like an impulsive need that if I get an email, text or Instagram message, I have to respond then and there. So I was like, best practice would just be to, you know, reach out to the Iroquois tipo and like period sent. And when I got back home, I was like thinking about it. I was like, just to let you know, I was like on a family hike. I didn't mean that to be curt, but like, you know, it's just because I'm a Plains. I don't know anything really about the Iroquois. Like, that's why I was telling you to do that. And she was like, oh my God, thank you so much. Because like, I kind of thought I overstepped boundaries. Like I really like ruins. And I was like really scared or upset you. I was like, no. I was just kind of busy. And this is where it came from. But, you know, it's, I don't really have an answer either. Because it's really, you know, you have a party. And in this case, David, who's doing best practices. And like right. trying to make sure that they're representing the group, because like David's passion for Indigenous peoples, both like not only in North America, but also in Europe and others, is comes from a good place in the heart. Like he's passionate. This is his job and he's spreading it to the other people. And he wants to make sure that the information that he is, you know, posting about is accurate. And another isn't like a social media liaison to a tribe. And knowing David from this original, I think he mentioned this to me in July and the post came out like late September.
I've been working on it for a while. Yeah.
Or early September, that he had sat on that. He's like, I waited a month. I haven't heard back. And, you know, ultimately they reached back out afterwards and said, oh no, that was great. You know, and it's part of that thing we've been struggling with as anthropologists and just researchers in general who work on Indigenous communities across the globe. It's like, at what point is it our ethical responsibility to not pursue academia or do something because we haven't heard back? Mm-hmm. Like, I think if I'm pretty positive, if the Iroquois came back and said, you know, said totally no to David, he would have been like, okay. But like a non-answer is a gray area.
Yep.
And it's also in the context of COVID. And as you said, Emily, they don't owe him your time. I imagine like if they did read it and had huge problems with it, they would have come out and said, you know, go F yourself.
That was kind of my thought with it too. They would have been like, whoa, no.
Yeah.
White is sus.
I mean, like I've seen this and this has been my experience on the Pawnee Nation Museum Board is like we get more often than not, now that I think about it, like tribal members will hit us up on stuff they see on social media and they'll go through, you know, a tribal historic preservation officer, an NAGPRA officer, and say this is not acceptable. Like the one I think that happened over the summer was when the Pawnee State Historic Museum yep. in Kansas showed our medicine bundles. And there was like a vehement response against it, where then we got involved and said, you need to take this off. And they did. And then there was another experience where there was a Pawnee descendant who was talking about, and Emily was involved in this. She made it aware to me. He's like, this guy is talking about the Pawnee Star Bundle and talking about it online. And I had to get in there. I was like, not only is this not a bundle, but this is inaccurate. And the dude was kind of a prick about it.
I mean, he blocked me.
Yeah. Wow. He blocked Emily because Emily's like, you shouldn't be showing bundles. And he's like, well, I'm a Pawnee descendant. And I ended up reaching out to the Tippo and he's like, he has no permission to talk about our bundles. And then so he ended up like messaging him and we're like, who is this guy? And we're like, who? And we were like connecting the dots. And he's a tribal citizen of another group. And he just happens to have like a grandmother who's Pawnee, who all of a sudden is like, wants to talk about Pawnee stuff. But not only is he doing it wrong, like he didn't show a bundle. It wasn't a bundle. And everything he talked about it was just incorrect.
Yeah.
So there's that form of scholarship. And he has thousands of followers on Twitter that liked it. They're like, oh my God. I'm like, this is the real issue because this is not accurate information.
My last question for you guys would be, and this is my biggest struggle that I like lay awake at night with sometimes. And it's not just with like indigenous posts, but like just other posts. But, you know, with the whole aspect of decolonization and like checking myself and, you know, thinking critically about what I'm doing. At what point am I actually helping, and not just me, like us with the podcast and, you know, with the Ruins Instagram as well, just am I helping people with these posts? Like, am I helping get indigenous culture out there? Because I do get messages from like Australians and Europeans that are like, wow, I never knew that. Or like, wow, I had never heard of that like tribe before, which I think was one I got the other day. Or at what point is it that I'm just putting a culture on display, like a mask in a museum, which is the original problem that Boaz kind of was like, nah, to, you know? And I don't know where that line is. And it's weird. And I struggle, like, am I just virtue signaling sometimes? But like, I have good intentions, I guess.
Yeah, I think it can be incredibly difficult. Like, I have to say, like, even sometimes as a Native person, I'm like, I'm in this academic thing and I'm doing archaeology, but like, is this actually helping anybody? And I think that can be the case in social media, you know, when you're posting about, you know, Native people. And I was going to say, like, Native people, if something's wrong with your post, a Native person will find it and tell you, because I have been I've been part of like Native people going after people selling Native jewelry and art who are not Native on Instagram. Like, Native people will find the posts and they'll tell you if it's wrong. And I know how much effort and time you put into those posts, David, because you and I have worked on some, you know, gender posts before about like gender and archaeology.
Yeah.
Or rock art before. So I know you're putting the time and the effort into it. But yeah, I think it's a hard question of like, how much does an incredibly colonial discipline actually help people who are trying to dismantle that discipline? It's a hard question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we will keep working on it, hopefully as a discipline and as folks keep having these conversations.
We should write an article. I think that's what it comes down to, is like, we should, the three of us and Emily and others should like write an article about it.
Yeah.
That's my solution.
Absolutely. Well, we just interviewed PhD candidate Emily Van Alls from IU Bloomington. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us and giving us a place, at least me and David, a place to ask questions that might be uncomfortable for us. So thank you very much for being on. And where can people find you social media wise?
I am on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Emily Van Awesome on both of those platforms. And I think, Carlton, does our book come out in I think it's spring of 2022. So look out.
Yes. The final draft is due October in 2021. And then the book is supposed to come out. We'll never make the deadline. Tentatively, think of 2022, sometime there.
That's when. Look out for it, people.
All right. And with that, we are out.
Thanks for listening to A Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins Podcast, and you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer.
Crappy joke, here's a crappy joke.
So, this joke comes from the series of dad jokes sent from my father. So this is dad jokes from my dad. Ladies and gentlemen, what do you call a bundle of hay in a church?
Oh, holy moly.
Holy hay.
Holy hay.
Christian Bale.
That's good.
10 out of 10.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Thanks, Dean.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.